literally have no patience for climate change deniers. It simply follows completely inconsistent that point of view with the reality on the ground, the facts as we are experiencing. You may not believe it intellectually, but your own eyes, your own experiences tell a different story, particularly out here in the West Coast of the United States.
Governor Gavin Newsom earlier this week talking about, well, just look outside your window. There's smoke everywhere, ash blanketing doorsteps, orange skies. The air quality is hazardous in lots of California, especially if you have respiratory issues. And even if you don't, too much of this, will you? We're going to talk about this now with Dr. Reza Ranaghi. He's a pulmonologist at UCLA Medical Center. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Well, even if you don't live right near one of these fires, the smoke seems to be everywhere here in Southern California and really, really bad in Northern California. So how bad is the air quality these days?
Every day is getting a little bit worse. Obviously, Northern California has had it worse for the past about week or so, and now we're starting to see it get worse on a day-to-day basis. And so by, like you said, just looking outside, we're starting to see a lot of kind of smoke filling the air. Air quality has just been getting worse every day in Southern California and Northern California and even Central. I mean, it's just all over California.
And if you smell the air and it smells like a campfire, is that a good indication that the air quality is bad?
Smell and by just looking outside is actually not going to be a great indicator in terms of is these smoke particles in the air. Now, typically, if you look outside and there's a lot of smoke or, you know, you smell it, obviously, those are the extreme conditions. And those suggest that, yes, the air quality is extremely, extremely poor. However, even in the scenario that you may not see or smell it, these particles can still exist in the air. We're talking about micromillimeter size particles that you may not be able to detect via smell or visually see. So it is important to keep that in mind. As the fires get better, these particles may still be there.
So these are, as you say, really, really small. I read that they're 1/30th the width of a human hair. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yeah, we're talking micromillimeters in size. So that is absolutely correct. And so visually seeing these is not definitely going to be something to rely on, as well as even smelling them. And even that size plays an important factor in terms of how deep these particles can get into our lungs.
So what happens when these tiny, tiny particles get into your lungs?
What they do is they get down and they cause irritations in our lungs. And so you may get a burning sensation in the back of your throat. You may end up getting a cough. You may get some burning sensation in your chest, as well as sometimes if it gets into your eyes, you may get some runny eyes and some kind of, you know, runny nose. These are the typical most common symptoms that you see. However, if you do have some underlying lung disease, it may also exacerbate and worsen that underlying lung disease, making you feel more short of breath, making you have cough and sputum production if you have some lung disease.
So that's if you have like asthma or something worse than that?
Right, such as COPD, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, cystic fibrosis, asthma. Anything that, you know, has your lungs have some disease to begin with, these fires and these particles can make those diseases worse, making you feel more short of breath and kind of having more of a cough.
Can they cause those diseases?
In short-term exposure, once or twice a year, here and there, no. In a healthy person, they won't. However, if someone is chronically exposed to these smokes, then absolutely, you can end up developing emphysema and COPD over many, many years of, again, chronic exposure. But once or twice a year, they will not cause any long-term diseases.
However, we live in an area that has smog nearly all the time. So, I mean, so once or twice a year exposure to these fires on top of all the smog, isn't that dangerous?
So, in again, the exposure to the smog, because we live in the Southern California, can cause some lung disease. And this has been something that's been studied many, many years on top of, like you said, exposure to these smokes. However, again, majority of us get such little exposure to that smog because we are indoors that you are not being chronically exposed to this kind of like a smoker would be exposed. However, we have definitely seen some patients that have lung disease just by living in a, you know, area like Los Angeles, where the smog is a lot. And now if you add an extra component of lung damage, such as smoking, you can just increase the risk of developing these diseases.
So the sad irony is that we're being told to go outside to avoid catching coronavirus. But you're saying the safest place to be is indoors.
Right. And, you know, for during these fire seasons, obviously, you know, everyone is telling us don't be indoors and definitely make sure that you social distance. However, during these fire weeks and fire season, it's really important to try to avoid actually being outdoors as much as possible. Again, for two reasons. One is these particles will be in the air for weeks to come. Even after the fire has been completely gone, these particles can still remain in the air for a couple of weeks. Second of all, the typical masks that we wear for COVID-19, being the, you know, just regular face coverings, these are not going to create enough of a seal or be able to prevent these micromillimeter particles from going into the lungs. And so they're not going to actually be protective if we are going outside. And so it is really important to try to stay inside your house, make sure all your windows are closed, make sure there's no seal that allows the smoke to come in. And in the scenario that, you know, you have to be indoors in a crowded environment, it's really important to try to socially distance as much as possible, keep that 6 feet, again, until this next month or so, we can pass these fire seasons when it's safe to go outdoors again.
What is a good mask to wear if you have to be outside and you don't want to get these tiny particles in your lungs?
No, that's a great question. And, you know, the most effective mask against these tiny particles is going to be the N95 mask for two reasons. One, because it creates a perfect seal around the face, not allowing these particles to enter. And the mask in itself, the filtration system that it uses, it's able to prevent these micromillimeter particles from going inside.
So those blue surgical masks, those aren't good enough?
They are not. And for two reasons. Number one, they don't create a seal. So definitely you're going to be getting exposed to that particle. And even the filtration system that the mask uses is not going to be enough to prevent those micromillimeters from going in. So if you do use that and go outside, you are definitely being exposed to these particles and to the damaging effects of the smoke.
COVID attacks the lungs, among other parts of the body, other organs. Could this also exacerbate any symptoms that you might have from COVID?
Your risk of developing COVID is the same as it was prior to the fires. And in terms of if you have COVID, can these fires exacerbate the symptoms? That is possible. Any disease that affects the lungs, and now you add an irritating particle like the smoke particles, can make your breathing and can make those symptoms worse. And it's going to be difficult to distinguish whether this is caused by the fire or is this your COVID symptom. So again, very important to try to stay indoors.
Dr. Reza Ronaghi, he's a pulmonologist at UCLA Medical Center. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the fires have had an impact on testing for COVID. Today and tomorrow, LA County is closing 6 testing sites in areas that are smoke impacted. If you have an appointment, you'll be notified by email or phone to reschedule. Coming up, contact tracing is one of the best ways to stop the spread of COVID. That is, if people will participate, why many of them refuse to. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. San Diego is a contact tracing success story. County officials investigate nearly all cases within 24 hours and contact people who've been exposed. That is well above California's goal of 70%. Here in Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti and LA County just launched a mobile app for contact tracing. But elsewhere in California and across the country, there is a deep level of mistrust toward contact tracers. Alice Miranda Olstein covers healthcare for Politico. She's been investigating this. Hi.
Hello.
Well, California was one of 14 states that gave you contact tracing results. How does the state gather this data, and where is it coming from?
So what we wanted to focus on, in your intro, you pointed out, you know, that states and local counties and local health departments are reaching out to everyone who tests positive. And many are reporting, you know, we were successfully able to contact those people. But what we wanted to look into is how many of those people that they reached agreed to give information about the people they've been around. The point of contact tracing is to find out who has been exposed and then reach out to those people and say, hey, you've been exposed to someone who tested positive. You really need to quarantine and get tested. And we found that very, very few people in many states have been willing to give that information to contact tracers, which just undermines the whole effort.
Yeah. Well, why? Why are they so reluctant?
So a lot of different factors, but essentially what the leaders of public health departments and experts who work on this told us is that there's just widespread misinformation and just a lack of information, just a lot of ignorance in the population about what contact tracing is and how it works and where your information goes and what gets shared and what stays private. And in that information vacuum, a lot of false information and conspiracy theories have just flooded in. And so you have all these wild things going around the internet about how contact tracing is a scheme to take away people's guns, or that they're going to put cameras outside your homes to make sure you're quarantining, or they're going to, you know, come and force you to be tested and take you away if you test positive. All of these completely false things. But this isn't just happening on fringe websites. People who have the ear of the president have promoted misinformation about contact tracing. People like Rudy Giuliani and Laura Ingraham. We found several candidates running for office in different states have also promoted misinformation about contact tracing. And so when you have that and you have the federal government doing almost nothing to explain to the American people what this is or encourage them to participate, that combined with a lot of other factors has led to these really poor response rates.
Well, you mentioned Fox News. Here is an example of what you were talking about. Here is Laura Ingraham.
They'll find experts who insist that the harm to personal privacy is minimal and that any trade-off is worth it. They'll promise their actions will be temporary and narrowly tailored. But invariably, these new programs, like what we saw after 9/11, will become permanent fixtures in American life and end up expanding far beyond their promised goals.
So she's talking about contact tracing there possibly becoming permanent. Is there any indication at all that that would be the case?
So, I mean, arguably contact tracing is already permanent just for other diseases. Public health departments all around the country have been using contact tracing for 100 years to track things like tuberculosis and measles. This is a very well-established public health strategy. And like I said, it's just to determine who's been exposed, contact those people before they accidentally spread it to others, and encourage them to get tested and stay home. That's all it is. And but because most people in the country have only just heard of this and have experienced it personally now during this pandemic, there really needs to be a much more robust public education effort here.
Is this distrust mainly along partisan lines? Like, is it people who watch Fox News and who are more conservative who are most distrustful?
So we have not seen a partisan breakdown. I would say that the people publicly questioning this, like the clip you just played, there is more that we're seeing on the right. But I think there is a lot of distrust and reluctance to participate that is fueled by things unrelated to politics. I think we've been hearing reports that a lot of immigrants are scared to talk to contact tracers because they think the information could be shared with ICE. That does not happen, but because there's just this lack of information about it, people have those fears. Also, people who know that a friend of theirs would not be able to take time off work to quarantine are reluctant to give that friend's name to a contact tracer. So you have our country's frayed social safety net playing into this as well. There's just a lot of factors that are impeding participation and allowing the virus to spread further.
Yeah. Well, not to mention the health of the individual people who are in contact with the infected person. They could not know that they might actually have the disease and get sick later. So it's in their best interest to be contacted.
Right.
What are some of the solutions that public officials are proposing to get past this?
So there have been campaigns in the past to explain and promote contact tracing for things like sexually transmitted diseases that have been successful. And so they said, you know, the federal government could be running TV and radio campaigns. They could be putting up billboards. They could have digital ads. They could have messages going out to people saying, this is what contact tracing is. We really want you to do your part and participate. This is for the health and safety of your family and your community, and really push it as an act of public service and something we can all do to help this pandemic end sooner. That's not really happening. The federal government has put out guidance on contact tracing, but that's not something the average person would see. I only see it because I'm a health reporter looking into this. And the head of the CDC has put out a couple tweets, but other than that, you're not really seeing a coordinated effort from the federal government to promote this. And local health departments, some of them are making these PSAs, but they are so underfunded and overburdened right now that it's really beyond what they can do successfully.
So what accounts for some of the outliers who are successful? I mentioned San Diego County.
Yeah, so we also saw some pretty strong success in Massachusetts, in Vermont, in a small handful of other states. And when we talked to them, they said that one, paying and training the contact tracers, you see a lot of states relying either on volunteers or on these sort of big call centers that can be very impersonal and don't have public health backgrounds. So there's that. There's also a major barrier is that we just have this inundation of spam calls lately that many people won't answer the phone if it's an unknown number. I know I don't. So one thing that some health departments have done to get around that is to work to make sure it comes up on people's phones as the health department rather than an unknown number.
Well, also here in LA, they pay people.
Yes.
I mean, you could just give them money to respond.
Right.
And that might work.
Right. Yes, definitely. That would be a good motivation.
Alice Miranda Olstein, healthcare reporter for Politico. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the chef who created Egg Slut, now with a new cookbook that honors his Filipino roots.
I remember going to the shop and smelling the bread. And as soon as my dad would receive the hot bag of buns, I would reach my hand in there and just tear one open and eat the inside.
Pandesal and other treats. My conversation with Chef Alvin Kailan next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, even if you couldn't brave the lines, you've probably heard of Egg Slut, the spot in the Grand Central Market that serves eggs, including its namesake, a coddled egg on a bed of mashed potatoes, a dish that famed food critic Ruth Reichel described as heaven on a spoon. The creator is a chef named Alvin Kailan. He's gone on to create more restaurants, Ramen Champ and now Amboy. And that's the title of his new cookbook slash memoir, Amboy, Recipes from the Filipino American Dream. And Alvin Kailan joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. What does Amboy mean?
Amboy, it really just means American-born Filipino. I think even if you're a female, they don't say am girl, they just call us Amboy. So if you're a Filipino-born American, when you go to the Philippines, they call you Amboy. And I don't know where that came from, but my grandma used to call me that when I would go home to the Philippines to visit her. She would tell her church friends, and she would describe me as, oh, this is my grandson. He's Amboy. And that's really what it means to me. And that's really what it turned out to be, like my flavors and my personal style of cooking.
You grew up in Pico Rivera, and your family was one of cooks, right? Your dad cooked, your great-grandmother, with whom you were very, very close, your aunt. Just describe your household. What was it like? Was there always a pot of something delicious on the stove?
Every day there's either something being made or something being prepared, and then our cooking. my mom didn't cook at all. My mom would always say that she was the person who cleaned up after everybody. But my dad was the chef, and my great grandma was the chef for the entire family when we would get together. And then my aunt moved in with us when I was in third grade or fourth grade, and she ended up having a catering business that she would do out of the backyard. So my house was definitely just full of food all the time being cooked. Like the smell of fried garlic and like cooked stews were definitely prevalent in my household on a daily basis.
That sounds wonderful. You talk about a dish that your dad made a lot called beef nilaga. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, perfect.
Now you're just being nice, and you describe it in your book as a hug in a bowl. Can you describe that dish?
Yes. So my dad and I think my love for beef is because of my dad, because I think beef was a treat. It was almost like a reward for working hard, because it was a little bit more expensive than pork and chicken. So when my dad would make this at least once a week, if not twice a week. And it's something that I ate my entire life. And just the smell of, bones stewing in broth and, the fish sauce and the soft, mushy potatoes that would cook in the broth. Having that experience, it really is the definition for me of comfort food. And I think now, my hardest days, I'll ask my dad if he could make it for me, and if he has time, he does. And it's something that me and him share. And it's a beautiful dish. And I hope when people actually get this book and read it, I hope they make it for their family, because it is so good.
Sounds wonderful. You grew up, and you kind of moved around a bit. You had a bit, as you describe in your book, a bit of a conflict with your parents, and you went to three different high schools in your senior year, and you weren't sure what you were going to do, although you always loved food and cooking and loved being around it, but you didn't think of yourself as a chef until later. When did you decide, I'm going to be a serious chef?
It was post-college into my what I thought was going to be a career in construction as like an account representative for a big construction company. And so when I was at work, I would rush doing my work. And then when I would have free time, I would look up recipes. And then when I would go home from work, I would spend the entire evening cooking and then eating. And then the next day I did it over and over until I was super fed up with my job. And I was like, you know what? Like, I love cooking, and cooking is something that makes me happy. And I was willing to do anything. So I packed my bags up and I moved to Portland without telling anybody. And I went to culinary school.
You didn't tell your parents or anyone that you were going to culinary school?
The only person that knew was my brother. And I even had a girlfriend and I just left. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't want them to stop me at all. I didn't want anyone to stop me, for that matter. I had my heart set on being a chef and learning how to cook. And I didn't want anything to get in between that dream. And so I just packed up and left.
So you spent some time there, and you, after graduation, you were in some professional kitchens and really learned professional cooking. And then you came back to LA and started this food truck. Egg Slut began as a food truck. First off, why did you name it Egg Slut? Because that's a little controversial.
It is. It was very controversial, especially when no one knew about it and they just heard about it. It was really something for me to shake up the scene. I didn't know how to make waves at the time as a cook. And at the time, it was like a foodie term, and I'm sure you remember this. Chefs were putting eggs on everything. Pasta, yeah. Rice, you know, and we would say, oh, that chef, blah, 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 he's an egg slut. And so we were like, dude, this has to be a name of a place because it's a great idea. When you're making a menu, you could just throw eggs on everything. And in 2010, that was like a really big food trend. And that's really how we came up with the name.
So Egg Slut became a big deal after, as I mentioned, that Ruth Reichel blurb. And you had celebrities showing up at your food truck. And then you opened up this outpost at the Grand Central Market. And then someone offered you $150 million to sell it. And you didn't take it. How come?
So when I say that, the guy was saying that's how much he could invest into the company to make multiple locations and turn it into a franchise situation. But at the time... And I still feel that way now. Mm-hmm. I didn't really care for that. For me, I've always wanted to create a restaurant that becomes an institution into a city. And that's really what I aim for. Even with my new restaurant now, Amboy, you know, I don't have the aspirations of growing, over 150 locations, you know, being a publicly traded company or whatever. For me, it's really simple. It's just to make great food and to be able to do what you love for the rest of your life. And back then, you know, no money in the world was big enough for me to like give up Egg Slut.
So in your new restaurant Amboy, you have traditional Filipino mm-hmm. dishes as well as takes on Filipino dishes that you create?
Well, we were. That was all pre-pandemic. This was going to be more of like a Filipino-inspired steakhouse. But now that, you know, we experienced what we've experienced with COVID-19, we kind of turned it into a neighborhood butcher shop, and then also order hamburgers, because hamburgers and having a butcher shop go hand in hand because of the trim and stuff like that. So, and it's also easy to take out. So it evolved into a burger joint.
What makes a burger your burger? What's the twist that makes it a Filipino American burger?
I think our burgers really don't have much pinpoint distinction for Filipino American, besides the fact that I'm a Filipino chef that created the recipes. We were going to make a Filipino style burger with pandesal, but you know, eventually what evolved into the burgers here at Amboy are my experiences from traveling across the country doing the burger show. And so what makes our burgers unique in general is that we have our own buns made specifically and uniquely for us, based off of a menu that we developed during COVID quarantining. And then we grind our own beef, and everything is done in-house. So, you know, when it comes to sauces and stuff like that, we do it all in-house. And it's definitely something unique in the city of Los Angeles for sure.
Sounds really good. And you mentioned the bread that you put it on, and this is pandesal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a sweeter bun. I guess you can compare it to Hawaiian bread loosely. It's inspired by the Portuguese style dinner roll. And it's topped with breadcrumbs. And similarly to our, like the bun that we use here at Amboy, we use a similar flavor profile to pandesal, but it doesn't have like the crumb and the texture on the exterior of a pandesal. We went with more of a traditional route. So we do sesame seed and poppy seed topped buns.
Hmm. You just wax rhapsodic about pandesal in your book. Like, the way you describe it, it sounds like if that were taken away from you, you would die.
Yeah. I mean, pandesal is a huge part of my pantry ever since I was a kid. You know, I some of my earliest memories with food is walking to Betsy's. It's a pandesal bakery up in East Hollywood or East Hollywood area. I remember going to the shop and smelling the bread. And as soon as my dad would receive the hot bag of buns, I would reach my hand in there and just tear one open and eat the inside. It's something that I love so much. And I think every Filipino and Filipino American can agree it's special.
You do have a dish in your book, which is perhaps the most ambitious dish I've ever read in a cookbook. And that is for a whole roast pig. But it's not just the cooking of the pig part that's ambitious. You actually have instructions on how to build a barbecue pit for the pig in the backyard. Like, complete with diagrams of bricks, and you have to go get the cement and pour the cement, the whole bit.
I mean, I think it's like a 7-day process in the book.
7 days. Wow.
I was like, you know what? No one's ever going to do this. And someone just hit me up on Instagram and they said that they read that part of the book and that they're going to do it and they're going to put it on their YouTube channel to see if it actually works.
Oh my gosh. I guess if we have a backyard, we have the time, we could try it.
Yeah.
As long as we're safe with the fire and all that.
Yeah, it's definitely like a themed party. It would be a themed party for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess we got to cool it on the party part of it.
Oh, yeah, right now, for sure.
But when that all comes back, like, where would you get a whole pig ready to do this?
Well, not to plug my place, but you can definitely order one from me here at Amboy Quality Meats in Chinatown. But you can definitely go to a lot of Chinese supermarkets, and they usually have one in the back somewhere.
Just hanging around. A spare pig hanging around.
Yeah.
Well, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks. It was fun. I love talking about Filipino food. So any chance I can, I will. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Chef Alvin Kailan, who founded the restaurant Egg Slut. His new cookbook is called Amboy, Recipes from the Filipino-American Dream. His restaurant, Amboy Quality Meats and Delicious Burgers, is in Chinatown. Coming up, Jimmy Carter was the first and maybe only rock and roll president. Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan are among his closest friends. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It was 1976 when a peanut farmer seemingly out of nowhere became president of the United States. Jimmy Carter hadn't actually come out of nowhere, of course. He was governor of Georgia, but he was hardly a household name. But he was well known amongst a group of much better known musicians, musicians who helped get him elected. The Allman Brothers, Willie Nelson, Bob Dylan.
When I first met Jimmy, first thing he did was quote my songs back to me.
Jimmy Carter used music in a way that helped him in his politics. It had never been done quite that way.
He was cool, he enjoyed our music, and he became a friend.
That's from a new documentary called Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President. Director Mary Wharton joins me now, along with the producer, Chris Farrell. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, so Carter was a reaction, of course, to Watergate, to President Nixon's resignation, to the corruption in the White House. Here he was, this squeaky clean evangelical who wore sweaters and seemed very moral. How did this guy, who looked like a Sunday school teacher, how did he form this alliance with these bad boys of rock and roll?
It first came about due to Carter connecting with a gentleman by the name of Phil Walden, who was the head of Capricorn Records, that the Allman Brothers were on that record label. And he introduced him to many of the musicians on the label. Charlie Daniels was on the label, the Marshall Tucker Band, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and, you know, some of these titans of Southern rock. And of course, the Allman Brothers. Also, Carter's son, Chip, who is featured in the film, was a big fan of Bob Dylan and Paul Simon, and he introduced Carter to the music of those artists. And when Bob Dylan was performing in 1974 in Atlanta, Georgia, and Jimmy Carter was the governor, he invited Bob Dylan over to the governor's mansion after the concert for a party. And they also, on that same night, invited Greg Allman. And the story of that evening is told in part by Bob Dylan in the film, and then Greg Allman picks up the story in an archival interview that we licensed.
Hmm. So did he initially want to become friends with them or meet them or reach out to them as a political strategy that he thought, oh, this will be a good way to get in with the creative class, the youth vote? Was it that initially?
I mean, it was more about impressing his son, Chip. You know, that, you know, Chip wanted him to have the band and Robbie Robertson and Bob Dylan there. And then, you know, the Allman Brothers. It was only, you know, a year or so later, as they started to think about the campaign, that they thought, you know, how do we incorporate this? We happen to be friends, and this does give us sort of legitimacy with that sort of crowd. But also the guys in the campaign figured out that it was a very good financial tool. You know, in other words, as it's described in the film, they had a concert, and if the Allman Brothers gave them the gate that night, you know, the government had to match the gate.
I want to introduce to you my friends and your friends, the ones that are going to help me get elected along with you, the great Allman Brothers.
My friends tell me that I've been such a fool.
The government looked at the proceeds of the concert was not a single donation of, you know, $10,000, but it was however many, you know, 1,000 tickets at $10 per ticket. And so they looked at it as, you know, 1,000 individual donations to the campaign of $10 each. And then they provided the matching funds. And for a candidate that was very much unknown outside of the South, this was essentially funding the campaign as it went along.
This association with music and this love of music that he had predated the campaign by a long time. And you know, we show that early on in the movie when that's, you know, gospel music, etc. And then certainly during the White House years, how important music was and what a big role it played. And then even to this day, you know, even to this day, music is still a, you know, a central part of his life. So it was, I guess the point we're trying to convey is it wasn't a gimmick. It was incredibly mm-hmm. important to the campaign, but it wasn't a gimmick.
Yeah. So you see, I think he had Vladimir Horowitz to the White House. He really loved classical music as well, but loved jazz so much. And interesting note in your movie that Jimmy Carter, when he was growing up in rural Georgia, absolutely steeped in black music, black gospel music, because he was, you know, he grew up in the church as well. And so how did he fuse this idea of civil rights and his love of jazz music and gospel music?
To me, it was, and you're right, it is a fusing of it, but it's a very, if you're Jimmy Carter, it's very natural. In other words, it all fits both with his religious ideas, with what was going on in the church, jazz music. I mean, it just all, and like you said about his beginnings in Plains, Georgia, it was just all interconnected. It's almost like, you know, some people intellectualize or think about it, and by the way, he's very intellectual, but he didn't have to think about it. It was just who he was. It was where he came from. And it was part of his, you know, part of his belief system.
Yeah, I think that his faith was definitely integral to his belief in civil rights. And, you know, he talked about the civil rights movement being the best thing that had ever happened to the South. But it really came to kind of a fruition when he had that jazz concert on the White House lawn, and he brought it back, you know, to the civil rights movement when he spoke to the crowd about what jazz had meant to him in his life and how important he believed jazz was in American culture.
At first, this jazz form was not well accepted in respectable circles. I think there was an element of racism, perhaps, at the beginning, because most of the famous early performers were black, and particularly in the South, to have black and white musicians playing together was not a normal thing. And I believe that this particular form of music, of art, has done as much as anything to break down those barriers and to let us live and work and play and make beautiful music together.
He called out our society as being racist, which, you know, was something that Chris and I were both very impressed by, that he was so brave to say that to a crowd full of, you know, congressmen and Washington lobbyists and whoever else was invited to the White House lawn, and all of those jazz musicians that, you know, whoever was alive at that time that was of the greats of American jazz were there. You know, you see in some of the clips that we show that Charles Mingus was in the audience, and he was just weeping he was overcome with emotion because of hearing the President of the United States acknowledge that and acknowledge him and his contributions to our culture.
And there's a really wonderful moment where Dizzy Gillespie invites him on stage to help him sing Salt Peanuts.
Yeah.
Salt peanuts.
Carter is still, to this day, like, he's still very proud of the fact that the New York Times complimented him on his rhythm for that performance.
But look at that clip. I mean, look how much fun he's having, and he's able to make fun of himself and enjoy that music and that, you know, that sort of moment. It's a really sweet moment, actually.
It really is. And then there's a serious moment too. This is not at that same concert. This is later at a campaign event where there are KKK members protesting and jeering Carter. And this is what he says.
I say that these people in white sheets do not understand our region and what it's been through. They do not understand what our country stands for. They do not understand that the South and all of America must move forward. Our past is a rich source of inspiration. We've had lessons that we learned with a great deal of pain, but the past is not a place to live. We must go forward in the South, and we will.
So yeah, there's Charlie Daniels playing in the background too. So how was he received amongst more conservative politicians from the South?
I think a lot of people in the South were, the traditional conservative politicians were not happy with him. You know, there was an element of racism that was rampant still. And, you know, but it's interesting, though, that during that time period, you looking back on it now and hearing some of the stories about what he was able to accomplish working with people on both sides of the political spectrum, it makes such a stark contrast to see the sort of civility that still existed during that time, that people were willing to work together to get their jobs done, to do what they needed to do. There's a great story about the first Chinese ambassador coming to the United States, and Carter's people asked him, you know, what he was interested in terms of American culture, they would always ask people like, you know, do you want to go to a baseball game? Do you, you know, what do you want to do? And this gentleman said he was a fan of country music and he wanted to go to Nashville. So Carter's people set it up to like have Nashville roll out the red carpet and have Barbara Mandrell play for him and you know, set up a brunch with Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash and Minnie Pearl and all the greats of the Grand Ole Opry were all there to have Sunday brunch with the Chinese ambassador.
The other thing, just to follow up on Mary's point about the you know, Nashville and China, et cetera, Camp David, still, again, no matter what people say about Jimmy Carter, Camp David is probably one of the most complicated agreements in diplomacy, foreign relations that's ever been accomplished. And that's an example of, again, his empathy, his genuine, his integrity, his honesty. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, so Camp David was his signature foreign policy achievement, the peace accords between Israel and Egypt. And yet, so there's that. And then, of course, there's the Iran hostage crisis on the other side, which doomed his presidency, right?
Yes. I mean, it obviously played a big part. But, you know, Mary did a great job of taking a very, very difficult topic and sort of finding a way to, you know, include that in the film.
So Carter, in your film, you say he would retreat to an office in the White House and listen to this music. He would listen to Willie Nelson during the hostage crisis to think about what to do on his own. How did he use the music to come up with his strategy or to think about what he shouldn't or shouldn't do? A lot of people were calling for him to bomb Iran and he decided against it.
I think that what he utilized music for is the same thing that we all utilize music for at times, which is that he found solace. And it also allowed him to maybe get out of his own head for a minute and just listen to these songs. The album that he's talking about is Willie Nelson performing those kind of classic American gospel songs like Amazing Grace and This Little Light of Mine and those songs that Jimmy Carter knew very, very well. And sometimes one of the great things about music is that you can listen to it and sing along and just remember that, yeah, your problems are big. And his problems were probably bigger than anyone could possibly imagine, but there is a sort of higher power. There is something out there that is bigger than you. And I think, you know, that's a big part of what faith is. And I think that's a big part of what music does for us as well.
He lost the 1980 election to Reagan, of course, so he was a one-term president, and then he went off to found the Carter Center and do all sorts of humanitarian work. He was eventually awarded the Nobel Prize. Jimmy Carter is 95 years old, and he did have that cancer scare recently. Mm-hmm. How is he doing?
Mary and I saw him in January. We had the pleasure and the privilege of screening the film for him, which was just an amazing experience. And look, he's, as you say, he's 95 years old. What I will tell you is he invited us to lunch afterwards. We spent a good hour and a half afterwards with him. He's sharp as a tack.
Well, thanks so much. That was a interesting, really interesting documentary. I learned a lot about Jimmy Carter that I had no idea about. I did not know he was a rock and roll president. So thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Mary Wharton and Chris Farrell. You can see their film, Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President, in select theaters and virtual cinemas now. Last Sunday morning, the sunshine. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for our show today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow. Been around here 3 long days, looking like a dad. Just step yourself outside, look up at the stars above. Bad.